But, Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vadhitamastu Madhidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
I was curious about when you said the moment comes when Sakshi resolves into itself. So.
Oh, I see. I didn't mean that in a moment of time, like all of a sudden, boom, Sakshi resolves.
I guess I wanted to ask maybe more elaboration of, does the self-evident self still has Sakshi, or is that just a mediator?
Sakshi is a concept.
Okay.
It's heuristic in terms of the teaching methodology. The Sakshi
okay.
is what we call when we're recognize that the buddhi itself is known, and we can't go any know, nothing interior to say, and this is the knower of the buddhi. Like you can say the buddhi is the knower of the manas, or the buddhi illumines the sense organs, right? So we have a seer-seen relationship there. But when you get to the buddhi, there's no one else to be performing that function of the knower. And so then the self becomes automatically in your mind, oh, the self is the knower, the self is the innermost knower, which is what we call the sakshi, the witness. Okay. But then this idea of witness comes because seer seen, seer seen, seer seen, seer seen. So that as though seer is called the sakshi. And that sakshitvam, that nature of being the sakshi, the witness is very useful in terms of the thought that's being known, right? Because the thought is known, right? So because of consciousness, the thought is known. So consciousness becomes the witness of the vritti, of the thought modification, as though. So what we have to do then is to actually look at the nature of what we're calling, when we're labeling the consciousness as the sakshi. And we have to look at the nature of consciousness to see, how is it actually a sakshi? Is it performing any function, any act of knowing? Because there's only consciousness there. How is consciousness directing itself? I know this, now I know this. How is it directing itself in terms of a knower-known relationship? And so as we unfold that and look at it, we recognize that actually the buddhi is illumined by consciousness, but not that consciousness is performing an act of illumining the buddhi, right? And so the idea of the consciousness itself being a witness of the buddhi in the sense of a knower of the like consciousness knows the buddhi, right? Consciousness doesn't know anything other than consciousness, but it's the consciousness is self-evident, self-shining. It is the experience of knownness, right? Because it's self-evident. You know, it doesn't require a subject-object relationship for it to be known. It is the knownness, the self-evident, a self-evident consciousness. And so then we realize, as we really start to get into it, the buddhi itself is known, right? really because of its adyasa, its superimposition onto self-evident consciousness. What is known, really, in the whole creation is known in that sense, because it is the consciousness that is known, and there's nothing in the Maya Upadhi, in the Maya, which is the kind of the material of the whole manifest creation, right, that is away from consciousness. And so the whole creation is known because consciousness itself is known in the sense it is self-evident. When I say is known, why do I say this? Because our experience of self-evident consciousness in reference to all of the objects in the world, which themselves are not self-evident, is that they are known, they are known, they are known, they are known. But the knownness that is superimposed on them, the knownness of self-evident consciousness is superimposed upon the object, right? So this object is and it is known. This object is and it is known. But if I get rid of all of the objects, they're all mithya after all. They have no being of themselves, of their own. Their being is isness, which is known. Is sat chit, right? And so the whole creation is known. Because it is Maya, and it has no independent being at all apart from the such a, which is consciousness. So that's how it is. Then, see, from the standpoint of, say, the jiva, we have instruments of knowledge within this creation, all made of Maya. You know, we have instruments of knowledge. We have a mind, and we have sense organs that allow for the a manifestation of vrittis that have different contents. Like if my eyes are open now and my mind is using my eyes, then what is filling the vritti is this room. Whatever falls into the scope of my eyes right now is what is filling the vritti, the thought modification. And that thought modification of the room, right, is known. Right? But it is known because the conscious being is self-evident, is known. Consciousness is the experience of it. Is the self-evident consciousness is labeled as is the knownness in reference to the vritti. So if I get rid of the vritti, what is left is the is-knownness of me. Say I get rid of the whole universe, what is left is the self, my self-evident nature. My self-evident nature is and it is known. It's not a knower, it is known. That's what makes it self-evident. So non-dual is knownness. Self-evident means self-shining. It doesn't. Self-evident means it doesn't require another pramana to come in to bring consciousness to it. Right.
But it seems like the sakshi morphed in this process of you unfolding this vision of the sakshi. It seemed like it morphed into something. I wasn't quite sure. Did it actually dissolve into?
No, there's no real sakshi.
I see.
It's that from the standpoint, from the atma is never a sakshi.
Okay.
But from the standpoint of a vritti,
uh-huh.
When I say the vritti is known,
yeah.
When I say within duality something is known, that automatically brings in the knower.
Okay.
Right. But that knower, the is-knownness doesn't require a knower.
Okay.
But in our mind and in our world of experience, there is knower known, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but even upon in the analysis of our world of experience, there's no knower.
Okay.
There's only is-known. The knownness is brought about through the utilization of pramanas, like the sense organs, for instance. You know, through the sense organs, my mind gains a vritti of the room. So that the sense organs are what is creating that vritti, which is known. So try to find a knower. You don't find a knower. You find is known. Everything is known from the self-evident me to all experience. But we have instruments of knowledge, you know, the different means of knowledge that we have to bring about the vrittis, which are known.
Why is it important of clarity that there is only one conscious being?
Well, what would happen if there was more than one? if there was more than one, then consciousness has to exist within duality, because there has to be time and space, right? If there can't be if there's no time and space, there can't be more than one, because there's nothing to separate it. So when space itself is objectified, time itself is objectified, right? It doesn't have the capacity to divide the subject. So if you say there, why not there be more than one consciousness? This is exactly what the Sankhya says. Every purusha is like an atma, and every individual has their own atma. Okay? But then what they have to say, there's a lot of problems that come with this, and that is, now since there is more than one atma, this creation that we experience has got to be real. And so the prakriti itself becomes real, real material, which is different from these many atmans, each of which is related to the real prakriti. It means prakriti has its own being, and every atma has its own being. So it's an absolute dvaita. Because once you go into duality, this is the kind of thing you end up with. Because the instant you say two, the somehow it... Sankhya falls apart easily. All of the darshanas attack it, because it has some real zingers. The things that just don't work. Okay? Because they say that every purusha is different, is separate, and every one purusha is infinite. Okay, so it's infinite conscious being. That's what the purusha is. But each person has their own purusha, because that purusha is associated with the body, mind, sense organs of the, which is prakriti, which is another reality. So when that happens, it's very complicated. It doesn't work that well. But in any case, then what has to happen for liberation is that this consciousness, right, the conscious being, the purusha, needs to be liberated from the prakriti. And so now we're talking about the prakriti of the universe, the prakriti here in this case of the body, mind, sense organs. So to liberate the purusha from the body, mind, sense organs, we have to bring it into really unmanifest condition, into total quiescence, where the sattva, rajas, and tamas is no longer interacting with each other. They're just rotating around within themselves, so that there is no more any manifestation. Which requires really the discipline of yoga, the Ashtanga yoga. And so that's why the Sankhyas look at Ashtanga yoga, Patanjali's yoga, as the means for liberation, for liberating, literally liberating the purusha from the experiences of the prakriti. The prakriti has to be stopped. And so yoga and samadhi and all these things can bring about that. It leads to where it leads to for the Sankhyas is that you need to bring the purusha, the prakriti, into total quiescence, which is very difficult to do in this total quietude, total quiescence, to the degree that it no longer wants to come out. And so, really, liberation safely takes place after death. Where then the purusha is allowed to be, to just exist without the experience of the prakriti. So anyway, why did I bring in Sankhya? Because once you say that there's two...
No, I'm not saying that's two.
No, I know.
When I say, why is it important to have this clarity?
Because
the mind can sort of accept that there is consciousness, but it's quite content to know that there is consciousness, but that there is only just one consciousness.
Because if there's more than one consciousness, then who is Ishwara?
Or if there's only one conscious being, say, that's one conscious being.
If there's more than one conscious being, then you must be different from Ishwara. Even if you say there's Ishwara is one conscious being, and then all the jivas are different conscious beings,
okay,
then there's no resolution into Ishwara. Because the vision is, I am Ishwara.
Yes.
Once there's more than one conscious being, then you are not Ishwara.
Mm-hmm.
So then the jiva, well, the jiva has to, you still have to make your own way and hope for Ishwara's grace. But you are not Ishwara. You see what I mean? Because you're your consciousness and Ishwara has to have his consciousness. If there's one consciousness, then the conscious being is the one, the conscious being from which the whole creation comes, and then the conscious being that, and that conscious being is the conscious being that is the self of all beings. Makes
sense? Now Ishwara is Brahman plus Maya.
Ishwara is Brahman with Maya. Maya is the kind of, Swamiji calls, incidental attribute of Brahman. Because there's no place to put Maya. Brahman is what is, right? So then you say, well, where are you going to throw Maya? Where does Maya belong then? Well, if there's no other place for it except for Brahman.
I mean, I can really connect with that I'm Brahman, but to accept that I am Maya also, because in the statement I'm Ishwara, I would also consider, I mean, if I would say I'm Ishwara, then that also means that I consider Maya to be myself, you know, in a certain way.
No, well,
but I'm not feeling that, you know, so I don't, I mean, I can connect with Brahman, being Brahman, consciousness, that I can totally connect with, but that I'm all this creation, that this, all this creation is because of me, also, I think that's also sometimes what's stated, right? That I have a problem.
What was that last sentence?
That creation, that all this creation is kind of even like all this creation is there because of me, right? It's like Maya is there because of me. And I feel like
it's not Maya's there because of me, because Maya is beginningless.
But it's
Brahman is timeless, Maya is beginningless.
Right.
But Maya has no being apart from me. It's not there because of me, as though there's some cause effect. The fact is,
right,
for beginningless Maya,
mm-hmm,
it has for its adhishtana, for its being,
mm-hmm,
the self,
mm-hmm,
Atma, which is Brahman.
Okay.
Right? But there's no cause there. It's not that Maya came into being because there was Brahman. It's that Brahman is timeless and Maya is beginningless. We say Maya is beginningless only because it's cyclical.
Uh-huh.
Right? It's not timeless because it's coming into being, going out of being, coming into being, going out of being.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes more sense.
And then you have to think of, when you think of me, make sure that the me is landing on Brahman, not on the body, mind, sense organs.
Mm-hmm.
Because the body, mind, sense organs are part of Ishwara.
Mm-hmm.
And you can recognize that because it's, they're absolutely objectified. There's a subject-object relationship there. You can objectify, you can be aware of the changing of the body, yeah? The modifications of the body as you remain the same, the modifications of the sense organs as you remain the same, the modifications of the mind, the changes of the mind as you that take place in the constant, which is me. That's what we mean by this pratyabhijna. The self who is sad is the self that is here now, happy or whatever, you know. The self that was in the 10-year-old body is the same self that is in this body. The self that was the waker is the self that was this. I, the one who is the waker, is the same one as the one who is the dreamer, is the one who is the deep sleeper.
Despite all the differences of our personalities and the things like I like this and he likes that and all these different things, yet everyone has the same relationship to the self, actually. That's sort of interesting to contemplate, you know what I mean? Because everything else, everybody's so different.
They're so different, but it's kind of like, it's a little bit, you can talk about it almost in Jungian language, is that even though everybody is so different, they come out, they have the same blueprint. In other words, the mind is the mind, the buddhi is the buddhi, the body is the body, like human body, animal body. We recognize human bodies, you know. And then we have different orders of reality, like with psychology is one of them. You know, and so the psychology is the laws that apply to all people. Yeah, because it's talking about the blueprint, but then every mind is filled with all kinds of different experiences and different relationships and all of that, but it's all being kind of held by the mind, which is basically the same in all humans.
But
same structure.
But the fact that the self is the most beloved, you know, to every being.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. I was just thinking about that because our minds are so different.
Yeah.
Filled with so many different things.
And all the different things we're all running after Ananda. Yeah, it's just that we've superimposed Ananda on a lot of different things.
Yeah.
You know?
Most beloved, but most overlooked.
Most projected.
Yeah, most projected.
It's
yeah.
The most projected. Yeah. That's funny.
Do you think there's more other cultures that find it easier to see the self? Or not necessarily.
Well, I think different cultures in this era may have more, maybe the culture still has more support of Dharma, you know, that gives more shanti in the mind. That's certainly possible. I think it's so, actually, so that the mind enjoys more peace and more Dharma. But whatever the culture is, for a person to really want to know the self kind of requires mumukshutvam. You know, all of us can realize that as we mature psychologically and spiritually mature, I think the natural thing is to mature in reference to Dharma, because you have direct, immediate experience of the doing to others. You know the Dharma already in reference to what you want from others, but more and more as we mature, we realize that that's how we have to treat others. And that itself is such a blessing to our own level of shanti. So we have that experience and we mature and gain more and more ananda, but the ananda is still something that is carried by the mind. You know, I get more ananda vrittis if I have a dharmic life. I have more shanti if my life is dharmic. And so we're naturally propelled over infinite lifetimes to become more and more dharmic, you know. But then to get to that place where to get to that place where I want to know myself and I want to know if there's anything about me that's free from time, that I can just say, okay, now all is well, period. All is well. That requires a different level of viveka, of discrimination. In terms of my experience, that requires recognizing that every experience I have internally and externally is finite, and so is changing, and so there is no stability, there is no thing to be achieved, because everything that is achieved will be lost just by the nature of time, by the nature of the creation. And so then how can I just relax and say all is well with me? I'd like to just, sometimes I use the example, I'd like to just jump off the boat onto the shore. You know, use that example. And I can say, okay, it's done. At some point I recognize that I can't be done within time and space. Not possible.
When you talk about okay with me, all is okay with me.
All is well with me.
All
yeah.
is well with me. Does that apply to like the carpet am, the lamp am, that?
Well, the carpet and the lamp don't have sukshma sharira, so the carpet is not saying anything, and the lamp is, as far as we know, is not saying anything or having any type of experience from the standpoint of the upadi, whereas the human beings are, the animals are, the plants are.
As far as fitting in, like
the lamps don't worry about fitting in, and
that was from Swami Dayananda, the carpet am.
When I'm using that talking about that, and I say, and so this is, I am, okay? We think there is a difference, I am, from this is, or you are, just because of language, okay? But my amness or isness is not objectifiable. You can't look at some amness. or isness, right? It's not an object within time and space. And yet, everything enjoys or has as its adhishtana isness. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is. Swamiji goes, you can say it two ways. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is, I is. Because isness is just isness, it's not an object. So there's only one. Right? Or you can say, I am, it am, it am, it am. Just to kind of break down this distinction between amness and isness, as though there's two things there. There's not two things, so that's why.
That helps with Dharma, like being in accord with the whole blueprint that way, because it's not just like me against this against is.
Well,
like
the knowledge does really help with Dharma, because you see everything, you really see everything as Ishwara, and also you are not, your Ananda is not at stake. What really threatens Dharma is I want myself, and myself has been projected onto the world, not to, onto this object or that object, and I have to have it back. I have to have my own ananda, my own fullness. And sometimes, you know, you are getting in the way. So, you know, we kind of you know, sidestep Dharma a little bit. Where if somebody did that to us, it'd be very upsetting. Because we understand Dharma in reference to how I need to be treated. And maturing is when I really get it, that that's how you need to be treated. Because we know Dharma, but we know it in reference to myself. Virginia?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a general question, but, you know, with the whole desire template that you talk about, I need this to be happy.
Yeah.
I often think in my mind, well, I can sort of psychologically go through, I really don't need this to be happy, I'm projecting onto this, this isn't really going to make me happy. But of course I still feel that way, but even though in my mind I'm already thinking, I really don't need this, and I
yeah.
can be all logical
yeah.
about it. But the doubt that keeps coming to me all the time is, how do you know that until you've experienced it? Like, you know, once you've experienced it, then you can say, oh, that's true, that really didn't make me happy.
But I think we experience it from
yeah.
childhood. I think we experience it our whole life, where you fulfill a desire that I really have to have this. I really, really want this, you know. And you get it, you know. And you get it, and you get that moment, that rush of happiness. For a very short period of time, you're glad you have it and everything, but let's move on. it's time for the next, is what's next.
Yeah.
And so what you recognize is that you do get a burst of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
The reason you get the burst of happiness is because for that moment that you fulfill that desire, your mind is desireless. It really takes maybe 15 seconds or so for that to wear off. For that 15 seconds, you know, you have like a little samadhi experience. I have what I want, you know. It doesn't last very long. And so then that same object that was such an object of desire for you is now just an object.
What I'm talking about is not necessarily object, although you may be talking not only about, I'm not talking about material objects necessarily, like a car or something. You know,
yeah.
I'm talking in general about the idea that you don't know because you haven't experienced it. So
what haven't you experienced?
I don't know. It's like you, I just worry that you're sort of ruling out things.
Like
by
what?
Saying anything, any experience that you might have a desire to do, to travel somewhere. Let's say to go to some remote place, and you've always wanted to go there. And then you think, okay, well, I really don't need this to be happy.
Oh, I
but,
see.
You know, I'm just
I see. You know, the thing is this.
I can't think of one specific
thing. I would say more like this. Because you have your prarabdha and you have life opportunities, you should just enjoy them as they come up and do them. You know, like say you have an opportunity to travel, and you think, wow, that's great, I really want to travel.
Mm-hmm.
Travel, there's nothing wrong, why stop it? There's nothing adharmic in it, it's just the unfoldment
right.
of your prarabdha. Just enjoy the energy and go with it. But now the thing is, okay, you couldn't get your visa.
Right.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah, yeah.
So it's all screwed up then. So
yeah.
then you have to say, okay.
Yeah.
So the question is, can you do that?
Yeah.
if you can do that, you can then you just go, kind of go with the flow, and life presents wonderful opportunities. And as long as they're within Dharma, there's nothing to stop you from taking those opportunities, unless it's not good for you or something, you know. But I wouldn't think, no, I'm not going to take that opportunity because I don't really need it. I wouldn't think that way at all, because then you're kind of blocking your prarabdha karma and blocking your life, you know. So it's more a question of how do you handle it when it doesn't work out? Mm-hmm. And that's when to bring in your knowledge. And you can say, it doesn't work out, you're feeling sad. Then you can say, you know, do I really need that for my ananda? Where's the ananda really located? If you want to, then you bring it to yourself. You see what I mean? Then that's meaningful. Because you're suffering, because then your knowledge kind of rescues you. You get you come back to yourself. That's how I would look at that. Does it work for you?
Yeah.
Well, do one more round. What is the kind of...
I mean, this idea that, you know, like, I don't know, I just don't think necessarily that the self is all, like, it doesn't make me blissed out, you know? I mean, it's just like, yeah, I'm here, you know? Like, I know I'm here, and it does calm me down. I mean, the thought of everybody being oneself, of all of us being the self, really calms me down, because it's like, you know, there's not this object, this subject-object thing. I don't know.
But there's one thing you said there that maybe we can say a few words about. Like the bugaboo, the problem with the word ananda is its translation as bliss.
Yeah.
You know, that's a problem. So then you have to think, what is the difference between the ananda of my being and a blissvritti? Because bliss is something, it's a word that's used for an extreme state of happiness, an extreme state of joy that we call bliss. It's sort of a higher state of happiness. It's an exaltation or something about it. Now, then you have to say, well, are these blissvrittis important to me? Is this what I'm working for in life? Is to have blissvrittis? Am I equating blissvrittis with moksha, or blissvrittis with having made it? See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something to work for? Or is it something that, you know, when I'm feeling really, really happy, or there's some beautiful, exalted experiences taking place, I can love that and appreciate it and think it's wonderful, but what if, because it is, it has its own joy and beauty, it's something that Bhagavan that exists in the creation. But then what if I said, oh, I have to have that again. Now we have to start working for blissvrittis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, do I want to work for blissvrittis? I personally don't want to work for blissvrittis. But there's a reason for it, is that the simple ananda of your being is in some ways so much more than a blissvritti. It's so different, but it's so much more than a blissvritti. It's just the depth of your own wholeness. And so the interest in these extreme states, avoiding these negative states and going after these extreme positive states, that kind of falls off. So they don't matter very much to you because of the depth of your own presence, which is so... It's a lot of effort. So if they come naturally, then that's something fine, but thinking to work for them, if you want to work for them and you don't mind if you don't get them, then it's fine, like anything else in samsara. And I think I'll work for these blissvrittis, that I get them fine. If I don't get them, fine, then it doesn't matter. That's how we have to be toward everything, you know. My prarabdha is to work for blissvrittis. So that's what I do. That's what I do, and I do it to the best of my ability. It's every day after day, that's what's put before me. And that's what I do.
So what I would do for like a mature jnani, like what would be one word that would kind of sum them up, like their mind, their mental state, kind of like this contentment, sort of, would that be the kind of...
I think what I don't know, but I'll just throw something out. Mm. I don't know if I think about it for a while, I might not think this, but because when I think of Swamiji, I think it's love for all beings. Mm. That's what I think it is.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. That's maturity. That means that it's not an emotional type of love, it's a objective love for all beings.
Mm-hmm.
And
not gushy.
It's not gushy.
I mean, like an appreciation.
Love, real love. So that's why when you're in the presence of somebody who is mature, you feel loved. You know? And so we're all flowering in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And everything that is an obstacle, you can always feel it in yourself, because if you're not feeling that way, you're not feeling that way. That's a sadhana. That means there's something, some closure inside, there's something that you're afraid of. That bhayam. If the sannyasa vow is abhayam, let no being be afraid of me, let me not be afraid of any being. And that, to me, that's so profound, this, that part of it that we don't maybe think of so much. May I not be afraid of any being? That's the whole problem in terms of Antakarana Shuddhi. I'm afraid of you because you have the capacity to upset me in some way or another. You have the capacity to make me have undesirable vrittis. You know? So I'm afraid of you. You know?
Because
yeah, you're going to... They're going to create these vrittis in me. That, you know.
And the other side? The other one?
The other one is let no being be afraid of me. But no being will be afraid of me if I'm not afraid of you.
Yeah.
Because if I'm not afraid of you, there's nothing that's rejecting you in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's fear. Fear. Fear is the, you know. That's why the sannyasa vow is so profound, and it's really... becomes, you know, it's the flower that blossoms in the sannyasa buddhi. You know, the sannyasa buddhi is the recognition of the self as being absolutely free from any karma, any active. That's the sannyasa vritti. You don't have to take orange to be a sannyasi in the true sense of the word. Or taking the orange is a lifestyle, a sannyasa lifestyle. You know, that has a lot of rules and regulations. You can't, as a sannyasi wearing orange, you have all kinds of karma, you have all kinds of responsibilities. Just breathing, just having a body, you can't be free of all karma. To be free of all karma is to recognize the Atma, the self that's free of karma. Right? So that the knowledge, Atma Jnanam, is sattva karma sannyasa. Is that I am free of all karma. I have no history. I am always the present. I have no past, I have no future, I am. You know. But when we take the orange to live the life of a sannyasi, which is a life that is devoted to just to really to studying, teaching and contemplating. That's the job of the sannyasi, really. You know, and there's other things you end up falling into just because of your karma, but that's basically what it is, and you wear the orange and you're living the life of a monk. Or you stay as a householder and you may be married and have children and working in the world. But whether you're living in the world or taking sannyasa, living that lifestyle, you're as a jnani, you have sattva karma sannyasa. Or you don't. If you don't, then you still don't know. So that sannyasa lifestyle can be very conducive to just being with your knowledge, but it also can be very limiting to what your upadhi at this time needs to accomplish, because you've cut off, been forbidden in India, how India is, you're forbidden to do all of these things. You just have to live a very sattvic life, and you might not be ready for that. And so that creates a lot of stress. So Shankaran, Krishna in the whole Bhagavad Gita is always trying to convince Arjuna, right? He's trying to convince Arjuna, you stay where you are and gain this knowledge until this world is like a beautiful forest for you, and you're living in your little kutir in your own place. Then you can be your sannyasi wherever you go. You don't want to go to an environment so that you can be a sannyasi. You know, you want to be able to be a sannyasi in any environment. Say we want to really own up our knowledge, but I find I can only own up my knowledge when I'm in the forest. That's kind of what Arjuna was feeling. To gain knowledge, to own up my knowledge, I need to be in the forest. And Krishna said, no, you need to be here, you know, so that you can work through all of these issues, so that they're not issues for you anymore. So that let this life be your forest. Let this life become your beautiful forest.
I am free of karma. You know, like if it's just me, it's one thing to say that, but if somebody's suffering and you can just...
But
you just let them be, you know?
But that's not what's being said, though.
Uh-huh.
Because when you're talking about the nature of the self, the self is one, and the self of all beings. So for...
That's what I mean.
Yeah. So that, but this body-mind sense organs is in Maya, right? And so there's all kinds of relationships going on here and all kinds of responsibilities. The creation every moment is presenting you with Dharma. So there's no conflict between there being one self, and then within the creation, there's many beings, all the truth of whom is all just one self.
There's no karma there.
What do you mean?
Like, at the dualistic level, there would seem to be a problem, but if at the level of the
self, there's no karma. At the level of in duality, there's lots of karma. You have a body. You're breathing. That's karma. That's an action.
I guess I'm still projecting pots, and I'll work on it.
Work on it.
Yeah.
We can talk about it later, too. Yeah. There's some... We'll just talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have a question from the text. Two words, ashrayam.
Ashraya.
Is that only used within the creation, or can you say that Brahman is the support, is the, you know, that, I mean, we were talking about,
well,
like, the body being, you know.
Well, that we're using adhishtana.
Right, so that was the other word that I wanted to ask about.
Okay. The word adhishtana is a word that goes with mithya.
Oh.
So for, yeah. Mithya, in order for something to be mithya, it must have an adhishtana. The adhishtana is the reality of what is there. And so for you to recognize something as mithya, you have to know the adhishtana. Like the snake doesn't become mithya until you've recognized the rope. Otherwise, somebody's telling you, if somebody just says, oh, that snake, that's not really a snake, that's a mithya snake.
Right.
Then you can believe, okay, they say it's a mithya snake, right? But you haven't seen the rope to know.
Right.
So one must know the adhishtana in order for something to be mithya to you, because you've seen what is actually there. And so Brahman is the adhishtana for the whole creation.
Right.
Right.
So then, how would you use the word ashraya?
How they were using the word ashraya in the text was that does the Atma depend upon something for its being? Does it have some support?
Right.
And so if it is supported by something and then you destroy that support, right, then the Atma will be destroyed. But the Atma doesn't depend upon any type of ashraya or any type of support.
Okay, so ashraya then is a word that is used within the creation.
Yeah, like a tabletop.
Like you couldn't switch it around and say
and
that.
See whether Brahman can be used as a...
Right.
The problem is that that's kind of a duality, you know, like Brahman is like a tabletop.
And the
Maya is sitting on
way.
Top of it. Yeah, and so you
I
pull
see.
Out the tabletop
yeah,
and the... So, I don't know of. I mean, it's possible that ashraya, that would have to be defined, in that way, because otherwise it's going to bring about a dual concept.
So it's more like a.
I have to look it up and see if there's any time they use ashraya. I know what you mean. Do they use ashraya like Brahman and Maya or Brahman
right.
and Mithya?
Right.
Is ashraya
right.
a term? I don't
like
think so, but. Yeah.
Anyway.
No, that's a good question. I want to just check on it to make sure that there's no context that we can use it like that. And I don't remember it doing it. Yeah. But there might be. It would have to be clear how it was being used. You know. Okay.
Is it Adhisthana is the reality behind Mithya? Or?
Well, even behind is the wrong word. Because the pot's, the clay's not behind the pot.
Right.
Right. So it's Mithya has no being.
Yeah.
Right? It has no substance. The substance is the Adhisthana. And so the Adhisthana of the pot is clay. The Adhisthana of the snake is rope. The Adhisthana of the creation is Brahman. Satyam Mithya, the Adhisthana, is what is really there, the Satyam. And then the Mithya, right, is what depends upon the Satyam. If you take the Adhisthana away, there is nothing left. So if I pull the clay out of the pot, there is no pot. If I pull the rope out of the snake, there is no snake. If I take the Satchitananda out of the creation, there is no creation.
Which is
because
what
there's no being.
About.
Because yeah, but
if you take
but,
that away.
Well, that's true, but if you take that away, you take the very what is actually there. So there's no duality.
Oh.
See, that's the problem.
Uh-huh.
Ashraya usually has the sense of something is resting.
Okay.
Yeah. And
okay.
So that's what I want to check because
okay.
if we can use ashraya in that way. I don't think so, but I have a little doubt. But I don't remember. If we can, you know. If there's some verse or something that is using ashraya as adhisthana, then I would have to make that.
Adhisthana or
adhisthana? Adhisthana. Adhi.
Okay.
Adhisthana.
I've noticed that the words nirguna Brahman and sadguna Brahman you do not use. Is there a reason for that?
It doesn't come up that much as a common word in the Upanishad. It's more of a yogic word. It's not that we don't use it. But nirguna and saguna. So it does come up. Nirguna means free of gunas, free of qualities. Saguna means with qualities. So saguna Brahman is Ishwara. Nirguna Brahman is just Brahman. You know? Because if I say saguna Brahman, Brahman with gunas, we're talking about Brahman with the Maya Upadhi, you know. That's how it's used, you know, so we can say.
It just for some minds it might be more understandable.
Well, say when you're teaching the difference between Ishwara and Brahman, you can bring in Saguna and Nirguna. But it would be, I think it's like this, those are, they're good words, there's nothing wrong with those words. If it makes it more understandable for you, then you'll be using those words when you teach it. Because you're going to be communicating the vision that takes place in your own mind with the words that you use. So if those words create that vision in your mind, those are going to be very important words for you. If saguna nirguna, savikalpa nirvikalpa. Savikalpa means with vikalpa, means there's still a subject-object duality. Nirvikalpa, there's no vikalpa, there's no duality, there's no separation, division. So savikalpa samadhi, nirvikalpa samadhi. Nirvikalpa samadhi, there's only, in terms of my experience, the presence, non-dual presence of my being. In savikalpa samadhi, that vikalpa, subject-object, is there, even though the mind is focused only on my being to the extent that there is no other perception or objectification. But at the same time, the outline of the mind is still cognize the mind, even though its content is only the self. But when that's held for any few moments, the outline of the mind is overwhelmed. And so the only experience that is there is just of my own being, even though the mind is still there in what they call an atisukshma vritti, means an extremely subtle vritti, you know, that is totally overwhelmed by my own presence.
So thus, in that state, when you're just realized in the self,
Recognized.
Do you know old perceptions that were there before in the mind? Do they just dissolve, and they don't come back?
Some dissolve and don't come back, and others come back and dissolve at a later time, and then others stay with you forever. but you know they're mitya. It depends on how kind of integral it is and at what age they,
yeah.
How deep the roots are. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We don't all become, every jnani is still different. They still have their different bodies and different personalities and different temperaments and, you know, different life experiences, different sensitivities.
Yeah.
You know, they don't just become carbon copies. Like, say you imagine the blueprint. We all have the relatively the same blueprint, right? So we don't get back to that blueprint, but, you know, devoid of all the experiences that we've had, because we still have our memories and the samskaras that brought us into this creation, too. Our memories, our experiences, our little traumas, and Om to Swamiji. Mm-hmm. Should we say a prayer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena margena mahim mahishaha Go brahmanebhya shivamastu nityam Loka samasta sukino pavantu Kale varshatu parajanyaha Prithivi sasya shalini Desho yamcho varahitaha Brahmanasantu nirpayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.